Access to free and safe abortion is an essential human right. We support the right to abortion unconditionally. Outlawing abortion doesn't stop abortions, it just makes them more dangerous. The state should not be telling us who we can have sex with, who we can marry, if and when to have a baby. We, the people of Michigan, open our arms to our siblings in Mississippi and Texas and around the world, and we'll fight for your rights from the cradle to the grave.
Welcome to episode 89 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. In today's episode, we're sharing commentary from Sansara Taylor on the moves to overturn Roe v. Wade, along with a conversation I had with an Ann Arbor-based activist who traveled to the Michigan State Capitol on December 1st to shut down the state legislature to sound the alarm on the emergency for abortion rights. But first, y'all, it has been a week. Let's talk about some developments from this week as they relate to the continued fascist threat. Let's start with a, quote, options for January 6th, end quote, PowerPoint uncovered by the January 6th Commission. The one which was found in the possession of Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who is now refusing to cooperate any further with the investigation. The source of this file said that he didn't directly provide it to Meadows, which pretty clearly implies that it was circulating within the executive branch. A number of senators were reportedly briefed with the same PowerPoint prior to the coup. As Hugh Lowell pointed out in regard to the PowerPoint Meadows handed over, quote, but recall that was what he chose to give the January 6th committee, raising possibility that what he withheld may be worse, end quote. To be clear, it's already patently obvious that as David Frum tweeted, quote, hi, it's December 2021, and it's now literally in writing that senior advisors to the ex-president of the United States plotted to declare a bogus national emergency, to cancel a national election, and seize the government by military force. The guy who tried to overthrow the last presidential election first by deceit, then by violence, is the far and away frontrunner for his party's nomination in the next presidential election. The American political situation is frightening and upsetting if presented in simple, clear words, which may explain why so much political talk these days is so unsimple and unclear, end quote. So here we have one more piece of hard evidence that what we know now is what we knew then and what has been clear every day since. In related news, as first reported on by Politico, Trump campaign lawyer Jenna Ellis wrote two legal memos in the week before the January 6th fascist coup attempt that claimed then-Vice President Mike Pence had the authority to refuse to count presidential electors from states that delivered Biden the White House. And sorry, y'all, I just have to play this segment from Trump from the Laura Ingraham Show on Fox this Friday. So have a listen.
It was a protest. The insurrection took place on November 3rd, which was Election Day. This was a protest, and a lot of innocent people are being hurt. A lot of innocent people are being injured. I would say the panel of judges that we're talking about didn't exactly like Trump. And if you look at the appointments, you can figure that one out for yourself. But this was a absolute protest, and people are being treated very, very unfairly. Their rights are being taken away from them, and the other side is not. You take a look at what's going on with BLM and Antifa, what they did in Portland and Minneapolis and Seattle, and nothing happens. But what happened? And by the way, people were killed. Nobody was killed here other than Ashley Babbitt, who was shot violently by a man that should not have ever been allowed to pull that trigger.
A protest? Nobody died? Look, we all witnessed as crowds of hundreds of thugs, theocrats, and fanatical yahoos armed with schematics and tactical gear prepared to take hostages, and much worse, stormed the Capitol, waving Confederate flags, leaving four dead bodies and hundreds injured in their wake, a noose and gallows, active pipe bombs littering the Capitol grounds, shit smeared on walls. Staff and congresspeople barricaded and hidden, fearing for their lives, all in the interest of maintaining Trump's fascist hold on power. every single piece of evidence that has come out since then has not only backed up the horror of what we saw, but shown what it was. That it was more brutal, more organized, and more coordinated from the top. And listen to this.
I have nothing to hide. I wasn't involved in that. And if you look at my words and what I said in the speech, they were extremely calming, actually. But I would think that the Democrats would like to see it. And I think secretly they would like to see it upheld.
For a refresher of his January 6th remarks, since it's been almost a year, let's listen to those calming words.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. And to use a favorite term that all of you people really came up with, we will stop the steal. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country. Our country. Our country has been under siege for a long time.
If you haven't yet read Martin Gelman's substantive article titled, quote, Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun, end quote, published by The Atlantic, I recommend you do it. Now, well, after you finish listening, of course. It's important that people read and discuss this article, most importantly, for the implications it poses. There's a lot that stood out to me, but here's one quote that I think sums it up. Quote, Donald Trump came closer than anyone thought he could to toppling a free election a year ago. He is preparing in plain view to do it again, and his position is growing stronger. Republican acolytes have identified the weak points in our electoral apparatus and are methodically exploiting them. They have set loose and now are driven by the animus of tens of millions of aggrieved Trump supporters who are prone to conspiracy thinking, embrace violence, and reject Democratic defeat, end quote. His article further exposes how January 6th was just practice. He argues that the threat of American democracy as we know it coming to an end in 2024 is a real and present danger. The attempt by Trump and other Republicans to overturn the results of the 2020 election failed. But Gelman reports that Republicans have been building an apparatus for election theft. They've analyzed Trump's crusade to steal the election, to overturn the 2020 results. They've evaluated missteps and have taken measures to avoid failure next time by working to change whose votes are counted, who oversees the election, who chooses the electors, and what happens in the courts. He writes, Trump has built the first American mass political movement that is ready to fight by any means necessary, including bloodshed for its cause. Well, if you're a regular listener to the Refuse Fascism podcast, first of all, thank you. This should all sound very, very familiar to what we have been making the case for prior to the 2020 election. Gelman, however, tilts our eyes to the midterms, to the need for Biden to change course, to be a quote unquote strong and clear-eyed leader who marshals his power and resources to face this challenge. But let's get real. The Democrats are committed to playing by the rules and relying on the norms, while the Republifascists are moving to tear up those norms and rule through an open terror and violence. I truly feel that we cannot squander the small window we have by begging Democrats to change. We need to marshal our power, our resources, into the streets to meet this challenge, independent of the will or interests of the Democratic Party. Nobody else is going to do it. We need you with us. If you appreciate what we do on this show each week, analyzing the roots and trajectory of this fascist threat, we hope you'll head on over to refusefascism.org after you finish listening and hit that donate button. As an independent podcast, we rely solely on your support. Okay, back to the roundup. As I mentioned, we have been talking about Trump's coup since, well, way before it happened.
We issued a pledge to the people of the world,
which appeared in the New York Times November 9th with prominent signers reading in part, "We pledge to stay in the streets, overcoming fear and uncertainty until this American fascism is brought to a halt. We pledge our determination to prevail over a regime that imperils the people of the world and the earth itself." We saw what Trump was doing in the months leading up to the election, undermining the process, saying if he doesn't win, it must be rigged, and as of late August 2020, already began calling it what it was, a rolling coup. And we organized daily protests starting in October. This podcast had numerous episodes devoted to this, and Refuse Fascism led numerous actions to counter this in the lead up to election night. In the days that followed before the results were in, and then as the fascists began their increasingly violent actions in D.C., January 6th being the third such action. Taking a step back, we saw this coming when we started this organization back in late 2016, correctly identifying Trump and Pence as fascists and actually meaning it, and understanding its implications, not because we didn't like them, but because we seriously looked at what was going on in the world. We knew that it was going to take a determined, organized, mass, sustained, nonviolent protest movement to drive out the fascists and the fascism that was on the rise. This isn't an I told you so moment, but a how did we get here moment. Not only did we say this, but we acted on this. We called on people to act on this basis. We called on people to take actions. Small, building towards large actions to prepare for major nodal points, to confront the fascists where it counted, to again try to oust them before it became too late. Leaders of Refuse Fascism put their bodies on the front lines repeatedly to do just that. And often we were met with not only silence from those purportedly on our side, but often derision, all of which is an essential ingredient in how we got to where we are today. And now that we're here, with quote-unquote serious people saying some of what we've been saying for over a year now, it might be worth listening to us about what it will take to knock the fascists off course, change the course of this country, as well as listen to the voices we're highlighting, paving the way to action and preparation for the action that is required of us. And maybe even more importantly, to look at how we got here in the first place so that we stop returning to this threat. And we need these serious people who are starting to write about this ongoing coup to talk seriously to all their listeners about what it's going to take to stop this nightmare. The need to act independently, the need to stop investing all our hopes and dreams and energy into collaborators and exercise our power in the streets. So I just got to tell you, taking a really weird turn, I'm going to talk to you about Steve Bannon and Matt Gaetz. So instead of being in jail, Steve Bannon hosted Matt Gaetz on his podcast this past Thursday. Gaetz said an quote unquote army of patriots should get ready now to fight for the U.S. Bannon said, quote unquote, shock troops divided into teams could take over some 4,000 government positions. This is three things: a threat, a strategy, and also an exposure of what happened the first time around. Because while Obama was telling us to give Trump a chance back in 2017, these fascists began a total overhaul of the people who make up the federal government, emptying offices, freezing hiring, and experimenting with every way they could to replace career civil servants with fascist ideologues. With the long-term damage they cause and with that experience behind them, what they could do sweeping back into office could be much, much worse. Jason Stanley, author of How Fascism Works, was on Mediasan's show this past week and said, quote, "If you want to topple a democracy, you take over the courts. It's the first thing you do. We have a court takeover," went on to say, "the results of the court takeover we've been seeing for many years. We see in real time why the courts are so important. You target democracy, you take over the courts and the schools. What are we going to do about a Supreme Court that has been stacked with conservatives, despite the fact that Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million in 2016, end quote. This is part of why we are spending so many episodes delving into what's going on with the Supreme Court. Speaking of so-called democracy, Biden's Democracy Summit struck many mainstream commentators in its hypocrisy. As Debashish Roy Chowdhury wrote in Time magazine, quote, "Narendra Modi, Rodrigo Duarte, and Jair Bolsonaro walk into a democracy summit, but this isn't a joke," end quote. This has similarities and differences from his collaboration and conciliation to fascism here, quote unquote, at home. The difference is that here Biden is attempting to recover the United States' so-called moral authority in the world to frame the U.S. as the friendly imperialist superpower in opposition to China and Russia. This is a stark contrast from the transactional and fickle foreign policy of the American fascists united under Trump, and this is one of the real contentions between these two sections of the ruling class. But it is also similar to his collaboration with fascists at home, in that his vision of democracy is most fundamentally about maintaining power, order, and broad unity amongst the ruling classes, of course, with the U.S. on top, not justice. And he will partner with the likes of Modi and Bolsonaro and Duterte and ultimately Trump, even if the order they provide is fascism. So again, my segues this episode, terrible. We are going to make a sharp turn into abortion land. On Friday, the Supreme Court of the United States issued their ruling regarding SB 8, Texas's abortion ban. They ruled that the Texas abortion clinic can sue over the state ban, but they will not stop the law from being enforced in the meantime. This is nothing less than the erasure of Roe in the state of Texas and the several states lined up with copycat laws. Lauren Rankin, author of forthcoming book, Bodies on the Line, put it well when she stated, quote, "This is not a partial victory for abortion providers. This is SCOTUS upholding a 6-week abortion ban before many know they're pregnant and forcing abortion providers to fight vigilantes with resources they don't have. They are telling you they're overturning Roe v. Wade. A 6-week ban is blatantly and intentionally unconstitutional. By allowing that to remain in effect, effectively banning abortion in Texas, the Supreme Court is telling us they're going to overturn Roe. They have power and don't care about legitimacy. Do you believe us now?" End quote. Many are applauding Gavin Newsom's test of SCOTUS legitimacy by him declaring, quote, "If states can shield their laws from review by federal courts, then California will use that authority to help protect lives. We will work to create the ability for private citizens to sue anyone who manufactures, distributes, or sells an assault weapon or ghost gun kit or parts in California." End quote. But here's the thing. This pro-fascist majority, SCOTUS, is not bound by its own logic. It is not burdened by hypocrisy. We need to look at where the commonality here is. The world that those on the Supreme Court, this pro-fascist majority, the world they are fighting for, where that commonality is, and it's for cruel brutality, for white supremacy, for unrestrained American chauvinism, for vicious patriarchy. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, wrote, quote, "My disagreement with the court runs far deeper than a quibble over how many defendants these petitioners may sue. The dispute is over whether states may nullify federal constitutional rights by employing schemes like the one at hand," end quote. She's right. The question is, are we gonna just stand her while the world burns down, or are we, in our millions, gonna rise up, get loud, and try to stop us? It's time to stop waiting to see how the normal channels are gonna play out. A Supreme Court stacked with Christian fascists is showing you their hand on SB 8 and Roe v. Wade. By the time you're done waiting and seeing, it will be too late to stop it. Now is the time to act. With that, here's Sansara Taylor.
On December 1st, the fascist judges who now dominate the Supreme Court showed their fangs. They made clear that they may well be willing to shred the constitutional right to abortion that was established nearly 50 years ago in Roe v. Wade. This would be a leap in the enslavement of women. That is what it is to be forced to have children against your will. At the same time, this would be a leap in the rapidly advancing attempt to remake all of society in a fascist way, characterized by open hatred of women, open white supremacy, raw America First chauvinism and violence, all enforced by a state that has abandoned even the pretense of the rights of the people, backed up by fascist mobs. A decision in this case is not expected until June of 2022, and the time between now and then needs to be filled with massive struggle, refusing to let this attack go down. To get just a sense of the stakes, just listen to some of what these fascist judges had to say. Here's Brett Kavanaugh.
You say that the existing framework accommodates, that's your word, both the interest of the pregnant woman and the interest of the fetus. And the problem, I think the other side would say, and the reason this issue's hard, is that you can't accommodate both interests. You have to pick. That's the fundamental problem. And one interest has to prevail over the other at any given point in time. And That's why this is so challenging, I think.
No, there are not two interests to weigh. Fetuses are not people. They have no interests, period. But really, this talk of fetal interests is just a cover. It's a distraction from the real issue, the enslavement of women. There is no world in which abortion is restricted that doesn't do grotesque physical, emotional, social, and psychic violence to women by turning them into incubators, baby-making machines, hijacking their bodies, their safety, their lives, their social standing, their lifelong relations, and more. And here's Justice Amy Coney Barrett during the hearing, suggesting that being denied an abortion doesn't matter that much because there are safe haven laws that allow a woman to just drop the newborn off at a police station.
Both Roe and Casey emphasized the burdens of parenting. And insofar as you and many of your amici focus on the ways in which the forced parenting, forced motherhood, would hinder women's access to the workplace and to equal opportunities, it's also focused on the consequences of parenting and the obligations of motherhood that flow from pregnancy. Why don't the safe haven laws take care of that problem?
Seriously? Beyond the fact that pregnancy involves an actual physical danger to the health of a woman, in Mississippi, for example, it is 75 times more dangerous to give birth than to have an abortion. Beyond even this, being forced to create and then give up a child is emotional torture. Torture that doesn't end after the baby is dropped off. And add to this the weight of thousands of years of patriarchal social judgment and stigma that is heaped on women who are deemed bad mothers. And let's be clear, just as the widespread lynchings of Black people did not only affect their direct victims, but had a terrorizing effect on the entire Black population, this kind of barbaric cruelty would not only affect the individual women forced to have children and then give them away. This scenario, which is just one of many horrific scenarios that would become common without safe legal abortion, would hang like a weight and a terror over the lives of all women and all girls. This assault on women's lives needs to be massively resisted. The fury of women needs to be called forth powerfully, and advances must be wrenched in lifting people's sights to and organizing them for the revolution that is needed to bury in history forever this system that would enslave women in this way. This is what Bob Avakian and the RevComs he is leading are fighting for, and you need to join us in this. At this very dangerous hour, the so-called women's movement is capitulating to this assault. They are accepting that abortion protections will be lost nationally and then trying to protect them in a few states. They are continuing what has been a decades-long pattern of fighting defensively on ever-shrinking ground as this assault grows worse and worse. And some are even promoting feel-good fairy tales that all this really isn't that bad, and we have a lot to celebrate anyhow. Listen to what Amy Littlefield, a pro-choice writer, had to say on Democracy Now! Last week. And note that she makes a big deal of the fact that her views are informed by and reflect her conversations with at least 50 abortion rights activists.
I think the most important thing that I saw was not what was going on inside the Supreme Court, which was sort of confirmation that they're going to do what you know, the Christian right has been planning for decades. But what I saw outside was an abortion rights movement that was really emboldened, that was prepared, that was debuting the messaging that is going to be needed to rebuild a mass movement to change the culture and to reshape the fight in the years to come after the right to legal abortion falls.
While it's posed mostly as an afterthought in her comments, it should not be missed that Littlefield is explicitly accepting as inevitable that abortion rights will fall. This is unconscionable. And what exactly did Littlefield see outside the court that gave her such confidence? She spoke about how some activists chanted, "Abortion pills forever," speaking of the medication that can safely induce abortions in the first 10 weeks of pregnancy.
Abortion pills are in our hands and we won't stop!
Littlefield explained.
As organizer Amelia Bano told me, Republicans might have the courts, but we're out here having abortions, right? They can't stop them. That was the point. They're in open defiance of the court. They're saying, you can ban abortion legally, but now that these pills are out there, you can't actually stop people from having abortion.
Stop playing. Of course it matters that the state criminalizes abortion. And all the more so if it unleashes mobs of Christian fascists and other fanatics to hunt down women and those who help them, the way Texas has. Just look at El Salvador, where abortion is so criminalized that not only are women sent to prison, but doctors are legally required to report miscarriages to the police or else risk prison themselves. Or look at Indiana, where in 2015, Purvi Patel was sentenced to prison for allegedly inducing her own abortion. The point in this is not that the state is all powerful or that there is no way to go forward. Precisely the opposite. But we have to confront this honestly and we have to struggle. The fury of women and those who refuse to see women slam backwards needs to be called forward and unleashed. It needs to shake all of society, like we saw in Poland and Argentina and Mexico. And all of this needs to be linked to and increasingly impacted by growing numbers of clear-eyed revolutionaries who, rooting themselves in the new communism and the leadership being provided by Bob Avakian, are determined to bring this whole illegitimate system down and bring a better world into being.
That was Sansara Taylor. Her commentary originally aired on an episode of the Revolution Nothing Less show. You can catch her full commentary by clicking the link in the show notes. Watch the whole episode it was part of. I wanted to add a few things that I was thinking of listening to her segment. First, another thought or two regarding the notion that abortion pills forever is some kind of radical loophole in the Mississippi ban. I think it's ridiculous because it is 5 weeks stricter than the 15-week ban Mississippi is fighting for. Remember, the abortion pill is usable only pretty early in pregnancy. Also, it's worth looking at Poland, where a year after their near total ban on abortion, they now have proposed a centralized registry of pregnancies that would obligate doctors to report all pregnancies and miscarriages to the government. If this passes, it will go into effect next month. This is the direction we're headed in. They are dead set on making sure that all pregnancies end with birth or punishment. It's time that we stop thinking that it can't or won't happen here as it is, unless we stop it. As Sansara was talking about Purvi Patel, I was thinking about Brittany Pula from Oklahoma, where at age 20, 17 weeks pregnant, 7 weeks before viability, she had a miscarriage. And this past October, she was convicted of manslaughter for this miscarriage and sentenced to 4 years in prison. You can read Sansara's recent article, Earth to Delusional Movement Activists, Abortion Pills, and Identity Politics Are No Match for a Fascist State at RefuseFascism.org. And you can catch her each week on the Revolution Nothing Less show, our Now show, on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on YouTube. Follow her on Twitter at Sansara Taylor. Next, you'll hear from Jessica Brzezinski, who is one of the Michigan activists that shut down legislature to read a statement in support of abortion rights. I just have to say that while the silence of those in support of abortion rights has been deafening, there has been a courageous few that are sounding the alarm, challenging and marshaling people to not capitulate this most essential right, but instead act now to save the right to abortion. So last week, you heard from an activist who traveled to DC to protest outside the Supreme Court. And today, I'm excited to chat with Jessica Brzezinski, who shut down the Michigan legislature the day of the Dobbs hearing to sound the alarm on the abortion rights emergency. So welcome, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with what you all did, because it was pretty bold. You're an activist from Ann Arbor, and you traveled to your state capital to protest for this essential right. You did it, I believe, on the same day as the Dobbs hearing, correct?
Yes, we did. We wanted to do it to draw attention to the Dobbs hearing And we also had a Michigan focus, which was one of our demands was for Michigan to repeal Act 328, which is a 1931 law that outlaws abortion in Michigan that makes it a felony to give people either a drug that would cause abortion or use an instrument to cause abortion.
Yeah, it's a really outrageous thing that it still exists. When you guys went to Lansing, right?
That's right. Lansing, Michigan.
You guys were in the viewing gallery and they chanted repeal Act 328. And you guys are going to listen to that now.
Streets. We are not impressed. We are here to fight for a real democracy. You will see us again. Repeal Act
328. Repeal Act 328.
Repeal Act 328.
Repeal Act 328.
Repeal Act 328.
Repeal Act 328.
Repeal Act 328.
It went really, really well. It exceeded our expectations. We started with doing speeches and a speak out in the rotunda, which is just like the center public area of the state capitol. We did that for about an hour. And then phase two of our plan was to go into the legislature. We went into the House of Representatives to read that declaration. Our original plan was we expected to be kicked out. We had a list of people who were going to read the statement out loud. So I was going to go first. And then when the Capitol Police pulled me out, then Rizzo was going to read the statement. And then when she was ejected, then Becca was going. So we had a whole list. They sort of outmaneuvered us. They did not eject us. Instead, they kept proceeding with their business and tried to ignore us. And since they had the microphones, I was drowned out. We only had about 3 dozen people. And at this point, we only had about 10 people on each side of the gallery who were able to stay. So we were kind of looking at each other, like trying to figure out what to do. It was really cool. It was sort of like a flash of group inspiration, kind of elbowed each other and were like, okay, everybody read. And so when we all read the statement in unison, it was very loud. It's a very like big echoey room and they could not proceed. They had to stop and hear us out. And it was sort of a long statement too. It was like a page and a half or 2 pages long. So we kind of hit a rhythm and we're kind of like chanting our statement. And some of the reps were recording on their phones and they definitely heard us. And the other thing I really liked is that we chanted at the end and we left on our terms. We got out of there. Someone in our group tried to do a banner drop, and for some reason, it really provoked the Capitol Police. One of our members did get manhandled, pulled by the collar, by the throat, and kind of like physically ejected from the legislature. But I'm proud of like our fighting spirit. I think we did everything we could with what we had.
I thought it was beautiful. It was bold. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that statement that you were reading. How did it come about? Was there a section that like stood out to you the most that was, oh, this is what we need to be saying right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the people who organized this, it's a new grouping of people. I mean, I think all of us have been around for a while as activists with different groups, but because the issue of abortion and reproductive rights has come to a head so recently and so strongly, it's like a new group of people that we got together. And so we have people from Detroit Will Breathe, which is the Black Lives Matter movement in Detroit, the Wayne State University College Democrats, who are actually quite radical, other groups like the Sisterhood Collective and just different groups around the state, including Mid-Michigan March for Reproductive Rights. It was interesting. It was like a real kind of hodgepodge of people, but that's exactly like what we need to, you know, build a leadership of a movement in Michigan. And we had planning calls where we hashed out what we wanted to say, what our program was, what message we wanted to give. One thing that we were very intentional about in our planning calls and in our statement was we wanted to make sure people knew that we were working to build an independent movement that was not an auxiliary of the Democratic Party. We weren't there because someone in the legislature was like, hey, you know, come and speak out in support of this bill that I'm passing. You know, so we wanted to be very clear about that. And I think we succeeded in doing that. There was one moment, which I really like this moment. It was a little bit like sharp-edged, but there was Representative Brixey, who happened to come across us in the rotunda when we were doing our speak out. And we were displaying a banner, which is against the rule, apparently. And she was like, oh, I'm going to get like a photo op. So she like jumped behind our banner. And our two members who were holding the banner just slowly lifted the banner up so that her face was not visible. And it was kind of rude on her part to just jump in. It was kind of rude on our part to like do that. Someone, but I really liked that because it shocked her. And it made it very clear, like, we're not here for you. We're doing our own thing.
Why was that so important to you?
It was a really good instinct because the default is that you follow the lead of the Democrats, that there's no other option for getting things done. And we are in the minority in believing that our power is in the streets. Our template is the Black Lives Matter uprising in the summer of 2020. That's how you get stuff done. And no, we can't call like a mass movement into being. There's something in that chemistry that's beyond the will of any individual or any organization. Nevertheless, that is where our power is. And that's the only way for us to achieve our demands. And my philosophy on it is we can't force that to happen, but it's going to happen eventually. And what we can do now is prepare ourselves to be able to successfully lead it when it does happen. And that's what we were trying to do with our 3 dozen people in Lansing on December 1st.
But I think that your message of where our power lies is so, so important. And it's being made really, really clear to anyone willing to pay attention in regards to abortion rights. People have for so long held so many illusions. The courts are going to save us. The courts are going to save us. The court's not going to fucking save us. And I think that paired with that, there's been the constant pull of very good people to subordinate the interests of humanity, the interests of people that can become pregnant to the Democratic Party and what's best for them. And where that's led people, it was for decades to not even say the word abortion, to allow it to be cloaked with shame and stigma. And now where it's led it is that people are capitulating in advance. Before Roe is even dead, people are declaring it gone. Instead of marshaling, as you were, the biggest fire alarm, the biggest bell that you can sound, whatever it is, to be like, wake up, pay attention, it's on us, we need to act. Those are just some of my uncollected thoughts on the matter. But I wanted to kind of go back to what y'all were saying on December 1st and tell us what your key message was. It was repeal the 1931 law.
That's right. Yeah. Act 328, repeal Act 328. And
I think people really do need to kind of see models of what to do. Mm-hmm. There's getting inspiration, not just all about tactics, but what difference it makes when people go and kind of break the silence and do something out of the mold. Part of doing that is understanding the why behind people's actions.
Yeah, that's really true. There's a difference between you got to have the right program and be fighting for the right things. And then strategy and tactics are a little bit of a separate question. So our statement, we said we support the right to abortion unconditionally. We wanted to make sure that we were not being in the slightest bit apologetic. And some of our speakers in the rotunda, I mean, told just absolutely heartbreaking personal stories where they tried to break through that stigma of the like shame and that it's, you know, a personal problem that you had. It's a social problem. We said in our statement, access to free and safe abortion is an essential human right.
I'm clapping.
We said that we pointed out in our statement to the legislature, we're all chanting together, you know, outlawing abortion doesn't stop abortions. It just makes them more dangerous. And we demand the chance to live a decent life. I really thought it was important in our statement to generalize because this is not just about abortion, obviously. One step removed from that, it's about building a movement for women's and trans people's rights that combats sexist stereotypes. And then obviously broader than that is about building a world that is good for all. But in our statement, we addressed just the kind of gender stereotypes. We said we want to bury the social prejudices that make being a woman or transgender mean that you're less than, you're less safe, make less money, have fewer rights. You're subject to stereotypes that distort our personalities and prospects, that stunt our confidence. You know, we reject state control of our bodies. The state should not be telling us who we can have sex with, who we can marry, if and when to have a baby. And we said, if we choose to have a baby, we demand the right to raise those babies in a world that's worthy of them. I felt really strongly about that part. And then we kind of like stuck a dagger in and we said, political concerns, fundraising concerns, religious beliefs should have no place in these decisions. And we said, we're here to care because we care fiercely for all people. We, the people of Michigan, open our arms to our siblings in Mississippi and Texas and around the world, and we'll fight for your rights from the cradle to the grave.
It's really beautiful. And again, I just want to underscore, people should take to heart this content of what they're saying. And there's no reason why actions like this should not be replicated across the country. We need to break through the silence and be changing the trajectory really quickly. I wanted to get your thoughts on what happened in DC in the Dobbs hearings. If you had any thoughts that you wanted to share about the oral arguments or about the larger crisis that we face, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I am glad that Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, will this court survive the stench, you know, of overturning Roe versus Wade? Because I think that is their one motivation to not do this is fear of their own perceived legitimacy. And one thing that I'm focused on, I do think they're going to either overturn Roe versus Wade outright, or they're going to uphold the Mississippi law, which erodes Roe versus Wade so dramatically. But I want to fight like hell in between, you know, now and when the decision comes out. But I think realistically, that's what we're looking at. And if they do that, I want them to not be able to survive the stench. I want it to be like such a black mark that people unequivocally see the Supreme Court as partisan political hacks that don't have any legitimacy. And that's the silver lining that I will try like hell to get out of this, you know, if they do this thing.
Yeah. And I think after, what was it, Friday, where the Supreme Court upheld SB8, Texas's abortion ban, which is a more dramatic in many ways than Mississippi's in that it's a 6-week ban. It allows the deputizing of a whole vigilante force to hunt down abortion providers and anyone who seeks to aid someone from gaining access to an abortion. All of that was just upheld and greenlit. Sure. Abortion providers can then sue with what resources, I'm not sure, after they're having to pay the, it's insane. And what to me is even more infuriating in some ways than the fascist Supreme Court is people continue going on business as normal.
Yeah.
People's lives are totally being foreclosed, not to go to the worst case scenario because anyone being prevented from getting access to abortion. But right now there are victims of incest who cannot access an abortion. There are 10-year-olds, there are 12-year-olds who cannot get an abortion and have not been able to get an abortion for the past over 100 days. I'm in the state of Texas after 6 weeks. It's outrageous. And I don't understand why we're in a situation now where that fury that people should feel for pregnant folks and folks that could become pregnant in Texas, in Mississippi, in all these states that will likely lose access to abortion immediately if Roe is overturned, why people aren't raising bloody hell right now.
Yeah, that is the question that we keep returning to, you know. I have theories on most things in life. I think people think that the only like practical, reasonable way to fight any of this is to fight through the vehicle of the Democratic Party. And I think that our huge task is building an alternative to that, that people have faith in and are like, oh yeah, that could actually work. Yeah, just our own organizing. You know, we need a mass movement. But there's all these ingredients that go into it that are really hard to sort of, I don't know, to predict and to see. I mean, the Black Lives Matter uprising of 2020, you know, in some ways it seemed like it came out of the blue, but we know it definitely didn't. That anger and rage is simmering there in the background. And sometimes it erupts. And I definitely predict that if the Supreme Court essentially overturns Roe versus Wade in the summer, that there's going to be a huge backlash. People are going to come into the streets. And I think those of us who are seasoned activists and who are thinking ahead to that moment really need to figure out what do we do with that energy. When we have that steam, how do we direct it? How do we guide it? How do we try to keep people in the streets? How do we not have it just be diverted into campaigning for the Democrats? I think there's really a lot of unanswered questions about what our strategy and tactics should be. I mean, we know the bottom line, you got to build a mess. But I think there's a lot of like interesting questions like within that, that I've been trying to sort of, I don't know, pick apart. Do we go to the Supreme Court? Do we go to the Pink House in Jackson, Mississippi and have a national mobilization where we try to keep it open, despite the fact that that's not legal anymore? What are the things that we can do that can inspire people and make people feel like we actually have a chance of winning this tactic?
Yeah, I also have been thinking on similar lines about the anniversary of the Roe decision in January. It is a day in which the fascist character of the quote unquote pro-life movement is made crystal clear. They descend on DC and they have been doing it for decades, having the national spotlight. It's very difficult to break through in DC on that day. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this year, it would be so fucking important to get a pro-abortion message that we're not gonna allow people to be slammed backwards. I genuinely don't know what that strategy is, how you break through, but I feel like there is an opportunity in that people, including people in the media, are paying attention to the story of the Supreme Court in Roe. But if you have any thoughts on that, I'd be happy to hear them.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that's going to be one of our opportunities, is the anniversary of Roe. That's going to be one of our chances to do what we can.
Going back to what we were talking about with what you did. Yes, we do need massive numbers of people in the streets raising bloody hell. I also do think that we do need those people who get it now, like you do and the people who are with you do, to break through the silence and to go out and take action with the numbers they have. And I think that that models for people the type of thing that we need to see many, many more places, where people are uncompromising in demanding abortion rights and abortion access. I wanted to close out with, we've been talking about abortion and what will work and what won't work in terms of maintaining the right to abortion, right? You know, what will work in terms of people getting out there and demanding it, and what won't work, as you wrote in your piece for Left Voices, about just being a tail on the Democratic Party and kind of going along with their program. I just wanted to kind of bring back the idea that what's going on with abortion rights, as essential as that is, it's not happening in political ecosystem where that's all that's going on. Mm-hmm. And we still have these institutions that are running business as usual. We're in a situation where the assault on abortion is part of this whole fascist remaking, where a whole party is going for unrestrained white supremacy, patriarchy, and the most vengeful America First chauvinism, and that is enforced through open and aggressive brute force, a dictatorship that tramples on and shreds the rule of law, or weaponizes that law into an instrument of further violence and terror, and accompanied by a whole mob culture where you have the violence from the state, but you also have the violence from the thugs that we saw are still on the march in DC, with looking at the Patriot Prayer folks who got all the way to the Capitol with the support of the police. This is the situation that we're in. And I think that it really does take us looking at the full picture in which this fight for abortion rights is being waged on. And I just wanted to get any closing thoughts that you had on that.
We can win the majority of the country behind our program, because the Trump program is just, it's fake. It's not going to get even any of his supporters anywhere or anything. And we have to be equally or more bold as the left wing in putting forward our ideas and taking these bold actions. It's not comfortable at all. You just have to take the step. You just have to jump out there, because the alternative is just too terrible to contemplate. And I am hopeful. I've seen so many things, so many successes and victories. And when you're marching with people, like, it's a feeling of power and connection like nothing else. I do absolutely have hope.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica, and sharing your experience with us. I hope that folks take some inspiration out of this. Go look in the show notes. You will find the article that I referenced that Jessica wrote about the action.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great talking to you. Thank you for your work.
Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman. Or you can drop me a line at Samantha Goldman at refusefascism.org. or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. You might even hear yourself on a future episode. I want to shout out folks who sent me music, who sent me letters, who sent ideas all within the last week. Keep it coming. If you want to support the show, it's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. It is giving season. If you are looking for a holiday gift that is under 20 bucks, go to refusefascism.org and check out our Refuse Fascism shop, where we have beanies, beautiful enamel pins, stickers, signs, I think an ornament. Go check it out and support the show and the movement to refuse fascism in the name of humanity. While you're there, chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can hit the button at refusefascism.org that says donate, or Venmo us, refuse-fascism, Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.